We are. Nehemiah Perek Yud Aleph, and we are going down to the wire here in terms of trying to finish this before the year finishes us. We're going to extend to the extent we can, but ultimately we have a lot left here. And I wanted to do a review at the end. So I don't know, you know, how that fits in. We're going to do what we can do, and we'll see what happens. But today I would like to finish Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11. I believe that it is an achievable goal. We are on page 1863. Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Remember how Nehemiah has been going, right? Nehemiah started with Nehemiah himself serving the king. As the king's cupbearer finds out that Jerusalem is vulnerable and under attack, we talked about how he found out. That's not something we're revisiting right now. The king, Artaxasta, the Persian king, says, okay, you can go take care of the walls of Jerusalem. Take care of the defenses. He comes in, he surveys the walls of the city, starts construction of the walls. The Jews are attacked by the Samaritans and their allies. Nehemiah arranges civil defense for the city. He also deals with economic problems. The needy are suffering under the wealthier and the more powerful. So he arranges for loan forgiveness and in general to take care of the economic needs of the needy. Then there are attempts on the life of Nehemiah, attempts to assassinate him or to cause him to be deposed. There's a fellow Tovia who is among his enemies, who is elevated by by Tovia's allies. But despite all of this, Nehemiah survives. The wall is complete. He establishes rules for the administration of the wall. And then he says, this is back in Perek Zion in chapter 7, we need to populate Jerusalem. We have a shortage of people in the city, whether it's because we need people in order to defend the city, we need people just to populate it so that there will be something there, we need more people in Yerushalayim. And they had a census of who is around, and then we took a detour. And the detour, again, may be going back to the very beginning of the Jews' arrival in Israel under the Persians, or maybe something that happens at this point in history in Nehemiah's day, we were not clear. However, there's a big public Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah, there is a campaign for tshuva, for repentance, there's a renewed celebration of Sukkot, and then and then the people are dejected and they feel that they are spiritually impoverished, and they decide that they are going to create a new national constitution, which is what we did in Perek Tet, Perek Yud. Primarily Perek Yud, chapter 10. This new constitution which creates either rabbinic legislation or reinforcement of biblical legislation, depending on how you look at it. And that brought us to Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11. We started on it last time, and it was our return to populating the city. How do you populate Yerushalayim? And we said in the opening two psukim, the opening two sentences were on page 1863. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, 1863. So we said, "Vayeshvu sarei ha'am b'Yerushalayim." The leaders dwell in Jerusalem. Ushar ha'am and the rest of the nation, hipilu goralos. They cast lots to bring 10% of the population to live in Yerushalayim, Ir Hakodesh. V'teisha hayados be'arum. The other 90% can go live wherever they want. And vayivaruchu ha'am l'chol ha'anashim ha'misnadvim l'shevet b'Yerushalayim. The people are so happy that people are volunteering to live in Yerushalayim that they give them a bracha. And we asked the question last time: what kind of volunteer is this? There's a lottery. It says 10% of you are going. What volunteers are you talking about?
Is it necessarily the same people?
So that's part of the question, is who are the volunteers and who are the 10%? And that's one of the things that we have to revisit today. One thing that we did last time, which I will again just note, is this idea of 10% of the population. We suggest it could be a religious act, like the identification of the tribe of Levi to do the work in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash, or it could be a practical statement that, yeah, this is about the population that we need. Did anybody do their homework and go investigate populations and ratio population from capitals? No? No one did that? Okay, well, I'm not doing it. But it'd be worth a worthwhile project, I think. So you get this bracha, you get the blessing for those who, as we say, volunteer to dwell within the city. So a question that we looked at back in chapter 7 when we talked about the shortage, right, was why don't people want to live in Yerushalayim. What is their objection to living in the city? And what we saw then is the Gemara at the end of Ksuvos, which I reproduced here for you in source number one. The Gemara at the end of Ksuvos is talking about the question of what to do when a husband and wife disagree about where they ought to live. The husband wants to live one place, the wife wants to live another place. So one of the questions that comes up is, what if one of them wants to live in the city and the other one wants to live in a more rural area? Can the one who wants to live in the city compel the other one to live in the city? And the answer is no. Why not? Why wouldn't you want to live in beautiful, gorgeous Toronto? What's wrong with living in a city? So the Mishnah says here, it's a Gemara in Ksuvos, Minayin sheyeshivas krachim kasha. How do you know that living in cities is hard? Shenemar, they quote our pasuk here, that they gave a bracha to the people who agreed to live in Yerushalayim. So if you have to give them a bracha for living there, obviously no one wants to live in a city. But it doesn't explain why. So Rashi, in the Gemara, gives an explanation in source number two. He says, Yeshivas krachin kasha. It's hard to live in a city. Shakol misyashvin shav. Because everybody settles there. It's high density. Vidochkin, and they press umekarvim habatim zu lezu, and they bring the houses really close to each other, right? Zero line property development. That's what happens. Not new, nothing new. Ve'ein sham avir, there's no air. Avo be'ir, whereas in an ear, which is different from a krach, ear by definition of the word, air, is to be something that's open and exposed. Ervat, I believe, is a related term. So the ear, the open area, Yeshino Supa. I shouldn't have translated as city. That's my mistake for translating it that way. I should have written an open city. That would have been a more correct translation. I'll have to change that. But he says, Be'ir, in an open city, Yeshino Supar Desim, there are gardens, there are orchards, Smuchim Labatim, right near the houses. So therefore you have space. Vaviran Yafeh, the atmosphere is nice. That's what Rashi, who lives in, you know, south of France, envisions for what ideal development should be. Rebecca.
But I think we have to also remember that this was before there were sewers and water, and so
not in whose day?
No, in cities. In any of these places.
In Rashi's time, sewers go back to the Romans.
But you think that in terms of laboratories, etc.?
Well, I mean, indoor plumbing in ground.
Exactly. But I'm saying cities, I think, I mean, London, 150 years ago, had issues with between the horses and the human beings. There was a concern that it was polluting the air.
Right. Hey, no, that's absolutely true. Certainly, the environment in living in a city is different today from certain perspectives. And there's an attempt to sort of plan more wisely in terms of the space. But at the end of the day, you can't ignore the fact that you live in a city. It's a different lifestyle. And a lot of people don't like being so cramped. Sorry.
This is a very romantic view. You know, all the country, you know, halcyon country. Cities are safer. Population is denser. Services are more readily available. You can go buy a loaf of bread.
So they should have you do the ad campaign to get people to move to Yerushalayim.
but that's not like they have a very romantic thing. And some people hold it, but that's not necessarily.
In those days, it's not safer to be in the cities. They attack the cities, not the countryside.
It depends who you're worried about.
The countryside along the way.
But there's also a big generalization here that all cities are like Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is like a whole different. Everybody wants a piece of Yerushalayim.
The invaders. The invaders, it's true. The invaders all like it.
That's what I meant.
Right.
Everybody. I didn't mean the president.
Right. Jews, not so much. Everybody else.
Does anybody talk about the fact that Yerushalayim has no logical economic...
Right, so they don't, they tend to try, because the Gemara in Ksuvos is the primary focus of the discussion, and it's not talking about Yerushalayim specifically, it's cities in general, they don't really pick up on that in terms of Yerushalayim. You're right, Yerushalayim has all sorts of problems, no real water supply, right, within the cities, what makes them vulnerable to siege, as one example. But they have to try to give explanations which fit more broadly. But the problem is this. The problem that we really have is that source number one, that Gemara in Ksuvos, tries to prove that city life is bad from the example in Nehemiah. But in Nehemiah, the city's not packed at all. It's just the opposite. We need people to live there. No one wants to be there in Nehemiah's day. So Rav Nevinsal, who is the Rav of the Old City, asks this this question. His answer to the problem is that it's not an issue of being packed. It's an issue of, and this goes back to what Debbie was saying, a lack of rural elements. He says you don't have vegetables, you don't have fresh eggs. That's the problem with the city. You think that city has everything available. He says, no, the city is lacking the things that are grown in areas outside of the city. And he says, Yerushalayim certainly lacks those things, because the Talmud describes decrees that were made when we came into the land that you weren't allowed to grow certain animals, you weren't allowed to farm in certain ways in the city. Specifically, gardens were off limits in Jerusalem because of the smell of fertilizer. No one wanted manure around. Roosters were not allowed because they carried around food that had creepy crawly creatures that they had pecked out of the trash. They would carry those around and they could contaminate carbonos that were from the Beis HaMikdash. So he says that's why they didn't want to be in Yerushalayim, because they would lack certain amenities that they could get outside of the city.
In terms of background context, isn't the Gemara the one that deals with the Shulchan Shavuos in terms of returning or not returning to Eretz Yisrael?
I'm not sure I understand your question. What's your question? Yes, it deals with coming back to Israel, and it deals with a spouse wanting the other spouse to go back. Yes.
So the whole question in terms of returning or not returning to Israel. So there's a background context for this.
I think it's actually the other way. Meaning, the mission it discusses, what if one spouse wants to go to Israel, the other one does not? What if one spouse wants to go to Yerushalayim, the other one does not? That's what's discussed there. And then, as a spin-off of it in the Gemara, there is the classic conversation about whether you're allowed to return to Israel and so on. But it's a spin-off. It's a separate... I don't know that I would view it as a background for this. But the catch here with Rav Nevinsal's answer is that people didn't want to live in Yerushalayim in the time of Nehemiah because of the gardens or whatever. Those only apply to Yerushalayim. Those don't apply to cities in general. Those gezeros, those decrees, were Jerusalem specific. And if you wanted reasons for Jerusalem to be a tough place to live, if you want to know why people don't want to live there, it could be, as Dahlia said, because it's always under attack. It could be the poor water supply. It could be the religious restrictions of living there are greater, which they are. You give all sorts of reasons for Yerushalayim. The truth is, not everybody views the issue of not wanting to live in cities as being about packed cities at all. Rashi in Nehemiah, take a look at number 3, indicates the issue is defense. He says the people who volunteered to be in the city, Amid Nadvim in number 3, Asher Nadvaru Cham Osam Lios Yoshvim Birushalayim Lishmor Ha'ir Min Ha'oyvim. These were people who volunteered to live in the city to guard the city from an enemy. You didn't want to live there because you were afraid of being attacked. That's the indication of Rashi in Nehemiah. There are other sources that you could bring. I brought you Mitzudat David, who says the issue isn't that it's packed yet, but it's going to become packed. Meaning you have this move to now fill the city, and the Mitzudat David notes in number 4, areas that have a high population tend to be expensive to live in. Right? The price of real estate goes up. The price of commodities goes up. He says it was considered to be a gift from them that they decided they were going to live in Yerushalayim.
I remember from a previous discussion, I think it was in this class, that on the Shlosh Regalim you were required to turn your house into a bed and breakfast.
Yep.
So in addition to all the other, and not charge.
Right. That was what I was referring to with the religious restrictions now, but you're right, we discussed it back in Perek Zion.
Yeah.
That you can't charge rent and you have to let everybody stay.
Right. So that's not just really a religious restriction, because that sort of has to do with, like, for example, if you're living in Jerusalem, you should bury the dead immediately that same day, even at night, or something. I don't know. There's all kinds of additional.
Right. Although there are no cemeteries in the city. Although Jewish communities have now made an art form of this, of putting cemeteries as far from the city as possible. I knew a rabbi from the Bronx who used to complain about how far he had to go to get to a funeral, Queens, Long Island, whatever. He said, when they colonize Mars, Jews are going to make a cemetery on Mars. And he was sure of that. In any case, this is our opening here. The blessing to those who volunteer. But what we haven't answered, and now we're going to have to address, is the question of who are the volunteers that we're talking about. Is this the same as the 10%? Is it different from the 10%? But there was also a more subtle change in the opening sentences. In Pasuk Aleph, in sentence 1, we distinguished between two groups. Who did we split? Sarei Ha'am, right, and Sha'ar Ha'am, the elite, the nobles, and everybody else. And the way it's read here, it sounds like the nobles go live in the city, and then the rest of the nation is casting lots and having their 10%. How does that play into all of this? All the nobles have to live in Yerushalayim? Is that like a price? Like, if you're going to be of the elite, you have to be in Yerushalayim. Is that, how do I understand that? And then the rest of the nation is the 10% lottery. So that's something we have to figure out as we go through this. So take a look at Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. Because that's going to kick us off onto this and lead to resolutions, not one resolution, but multiple resolutions for this problem. Ve'ela Rashei HaMedina Asher Yashvu B'Yerushalayim. And here are the leaders of the nation who dwelled in Jerusalem. Uve'arei Yehuda Yashvu Ish Ba'achuzaso Ba'areihem. And in the cities of Yehuda, each person lived in his portion in their cities. Yisrael, Kohanim, Alevim, HaNesinim. Remember the Nesinim who work for the Beis HaMikdash. Uvnei Abdei Shlomo and the descendants of Solomon's servants who we've discussed before. So we're now going to get a list of who is going to dwell in Yerushalayim. These are the Rashei HaMedina, the Sarim, the officers, the leaders. And it's incredibly confusing as you read it in terms of who these people are and where they fit into the volunteers and everything else. Not to mention, we're now getting another name list. We're going to have another list of names. Who is it who's living in Yerushalayim? Who is it who's living in all of the other cities? So I see the way I structured it on the sheet. The truth is, given the opportunity, I'll probably reverse things a little bit, but I'm going to go with the order as it is on the sheet in order to be consistent and minimize confusion. So we're going to talk first about the name list, and then talk about the 10% and the nobles and the volunteers. So I brought you Rabbi Angel's comment. Remember that we referred in the very beginning of Ezra to Rabbi Angel's work on the name lists, where he tries to talk about why we have so many lists of names in Ezra and Nehemiah. So he argues that the reason why you need this list of names here is to link us with the past, because these names aren't just individual names. Take a quick peek at Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. How many families are listed in sentence 4? How many families are enumerated here? One. How many names do we get? How many generations of that one family do we get? Ataya, Uziah, Zechariah, Amariah, Shfatiah, Mahalalel, Peretz. We're going 7 generations. Right? All the way back to Peretz, son of Yehuda. Why? What are we doing? And it's going to keep on going. Look at the next sentence. One family from Shelah. So, Shelah, of course, is also a son of Yehuda. Or assuming that's Shelah, maybe it's not. Maybe it's Shiloh. Dav Mikva thinks it's Shelah. He thinks it is indeed from Shelah. So you have Maaseya Baruch, Kol Choseh, which is a great name, Chazaya, Adaya, Yo Yariv, Zechariah, Shelah. Are that 8 names? Some of these are names we've seen before. Some of them are new names. Some of them are names that just happen to show up a lot, like the name Zechariah or Yo Yariv. These are names we've seen in other contexts. But the point is that you're getting all of these generations. So he claims, what you see in number 5, that the point is to link the current generation settling in Yerushalayim with previous generations. He says, following the Reformation, Nehemiah chapters 11 and 12 is dedicated to lengthy pedigrees and name lists of the people who settled in Jerusalem. These celebratory name lists enumerate members of the earlier generations alongside those who rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem, thereby bridging the generations. It's about linking with the past. That's one way to take it. What else could you say? What other reasons do we have for this?
Is it going to give more than Yehuda and Benjamin? Is it going to, like, those, Yerushalayim originally was the...
So it's primarily, this list is basically going to be Yehuda, Benjamin, and Shevet Levi. That's more or less what you're going to see. Susan?
Maybe to validate the people of today, because, like, who are you? Well, this is who you are. We can prove you have the lineage and all
of that. Right, so that's going to be angels' drive for this, is it gives them authenticity. But I think as a separate point, what you then said about lineage matters a great deal. We're tracking, as we've tracked all through this, who can marry whom. So here is your pedigree. I think there's an element also of honoring these elites. These are the leaders of the nation who are dwelling there. So we're going to give them the full coat of arms, so to speak. Seven generations, eight generations, all the way back to Judah, which you can't really be, just parenthetically.
Right.
Meaning eight generations in their day is, you know, going to cover, you know, 250 years, maybe, probably less.
They should be commanders, right? So
yeah. So clearly what we're doing is we're just naming the names that everybody would know, right? Within the line, famous, you know, Zechariah, Yoyariv, whatever it is, that's who we're going to mention. We're not mentioning all the generations. You can't. I mean, you don't have enough room, let alone whether you have the documentation. In terms of the question that was asked, though, about who we're listing here, we're going to list Yehuda, we're going to list Binyamin, which makes sense, right? Why those? Well, it's their territory.
Real estate purposes to that you want to piece the land.
So it doesn't.
Is that the reason they're right.
It doesn't give them a place. It just says in the city. So I wouldn't necessarily tie it to real estate. Yeah.
Were the other tribes even in existence?
Good. So we're going to come back to Janine's question shortly. It's an important question. And the answer is yes, somewhat. But Yehuda and Binyamin were the two tribes that weren't expelled. We saw already that it's true that there were fragments of the other tribes as well. When we say 10 tribes are gone, it doesn't mean all of them are gone. It's not true. First of all, Levi is still there. Right? You have Kohanim and Levi are still there. Shimon, remember, had cities within Yehuda. So there are going to be some Shimon people who are still going to be around who remain. And we saw, when we talked about the whole story with the Samaritans in the first place, there were others who remained, but not in real numbers. The real numbers are Yehuda and Binyamin. So take a look on your sheet at source number 6. Radak in Melachim Bet, Kings 2. He is talking about after the 10 tribes are exiled. And he says, Habamot, the altars, meaning private altars that were often used, unfortunately, for idolatry, Hayu Adayin Kayamin, they were still around after the exile of the 10 northern tribes. Vegam She'erit Nishara Ba'aretz Achar Galot Yisrael, and some remnant remained even after Yisrael, the northern kingdom, had been exiled. Mepuzarim Ba'aretz, scattered around the land, Ze'er Sham, a little here, a little there. And they still worshipped idols. And he says, I'll prove it to you. He quotes you the 30th chapter in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles. The days of King Yoshiahu, you have people from Ephraim. What is Ephraim doing there? Menasha. What is Menasha doing there? The answer is, you had some around. And so too in the days of King Chizkiyahu, who was around at the time when the Assyrians exiled the northern tribes. You have a whole bunch from these various tribes. And there's a medrash that says Yirmiyahu actually brought back some of the 10 lost tribes and Yoshiahu reigned over them. The Gemara actually, he added a letter. If I remember correctly, the Gemara says not that he brought back some of the 10 tribes, but he actually brought back the 10 tribes. He added a sum, which is good, because otherwise he would completely kill the industry for the whole lost tribe business. Right? All the different arguments on who they are, if you take out the letter mem, it will be shown to be phony. That's no good. The Medrash in Seder Olam says it has to be so. that there are people from other tribes. Because when you go back to the census, when Zerubbabel comes with that first aliyah to Israel, so we said that there were 42,360 people. But we gave numbers for how many were in each family, and it didn't add up. There were only 30,000 and change. So in verse number 7, he says, "Ubifrat," when you actually enumerate them, "Einan ela shloshim elef u'shlosh meyos v'shishim." You only have 30,360. "Ushnem asar elef," where's the other 12,000? "Ela elu shalom mishar shvatim." So the answer is not only were there some originally who went into exile with them from the different tribes, but they also came back. So you do have some of the other tribes. Nonetheless, Yehuda and Binyamin are clearly, and Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi, are the dominant elements of society at this point. And the answer simply is, and Mitzudat David says it explicitly, that they are omitted here only because there were only a few of them. You didn't have a lot. Okay, so now we know a little bit about the name list and why it's here. Whether it's for pedigree, authenticity, to celebrate the elite, whichever answer we're going to bring. And now we know as well that it's primarily Yehuda, Binyamin, the tribe of Levi, even though there were others who were around, they weren't in real numbers. Susan?
Are we saying that there was
Right, so that was one of the big highlights when we started Sefer Ezra, was this realization that people actually cared to retain tribal identity. It's part of the fact that they believed they were coming back. We're going to be back. We need to know where our land is. We need to know where we belong. And so, yes, they retain that identity. Yeah. Now, keep in mind, this doesn't prevent marriage between the tribes. It's just that the tribal identity is going to be paternal. Right? Because you only allow polygamy and not polyandry, right, in order to maximize reproduction, you allow polygamy, you ban polyandry, the result is that you have to make your tribal identity by the male. You don't have a choice. Because if you make it by the female, then your families are going to have multiple tribes and you're not going to know where the land belongs and where you're supposed to go.
So we lost everybody after the second temple.
Correct.
We lost all the Hutu.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yes. Yep. And the Jews living in Ethiopia who said we're from the tribe of Dan. Okay. Okay. Eldad Hadani also had a few other tribes that he said were mixed in, but they become known as the tribe of Dan. Okay. So, all right. Now I know that we have that we have this list of the elites, and we're going to get their records. But I don't understand how this fits with the volunteers. I don't understand how this fits with the 10%. So in number 8, I tried to make things easy by giving you 4 different explanations. You can just read as many as you wish of 4 and just tune out for the rest, and that's fine. But the first approach is Rashi's approach. And I brought you the Rashi in number 9, but just to say it outside first. He says, the list we're getting here is the list of the elite who volunteered. And as you read Rashi, it's not clear. They may also count towards the 10%. It could be that Nehemiah wanted 10% altogether, and that these would be within the 10%. So when you read the opening sentence of the chapter, that the leaders of the nation dwelled in Yerushalayim and everybody else cast lots, that means the elite volunteered. They're among the volunteers. However, there were others who volunteered as well, and that's what it says in sentence 2, that they blessed everybody who volunteered, wasn't just the elite. So take a look at Rashi in number 9. He says, from the descendants of Yehuda, Ataya, and so on, Choseru Mufaresh Mibnei Yehuda. The text explains who from Yehuda, mi v'mihayu, which ones they were, v'chol ha'parsha eina monakim ha'gdolim v'chashuvim shebahem, and it's just mentioning the people who were of stature. That's who you're going to list here. It's the elites who did volunteer, but may not be the only volunteers, and they may be part of the 10%. Then you have Malbim. I didn't bring you Malbim on the sheet. I brought you only his explanation in number 8. And Malbim, like Rashi, says that it is a list of the elite. You can't get around that. They are the leaders. They are from among the volunteers, and they are not the 10%, and they are not the general volunteers. There were volunteers who were the leaders, and there were volunteers who were from everybody else, and these don't count towards the 10%. It's 10% plus whoever chose to go. Then you have Ralbach, and Ralbach says it's a list of the elites who are indeed the volunteers, and they are the only volunteers. That's it, it's just them. And everybody else is the 10% who are drawn by lottery. If you flip the page into number 10, you see Ralbach. And after that, he says, Hishtadel sheyeshvu sarei ha'am b'Yerushalayim. He wanted to have the leaders live in Yerushalayim. V'hipilu garalos la'avi achad me'asara mish'ar ha'am la'sheves b'Yerushalayim. They cast lots to bring one-tenth of the rest of the nation. I should have put that in my translation. I don't know why that's missing. They to dwell in Yerushalayim. Uktsasam hisnadvu od me'atzmam, and some of them volunteered, l'sheves b'Yerushalayim, to live in Jerusalem. Uberchu es ha'am, and they blessed, uberchu ha'am es ha'misnadvim, the nation blessed those who volunteered. I see what I did. I jumped in my translation. Kihem azru l'hashiv Yerushalayim al yanar rishon, because they helped Yerushalayim to be restored to its original state. Rotzalomar livnos charvoseha, meaning to build up its ruins. So what Ralbach is saying is, they wanted the nobles to move there. They cast lots to bring one-tenth of the nation. Some of them volunteered. Who are the ones who volunteered? He concludes by saying, those are the national leaders. So the leaders are the ones who volunteer, and then it's one-tenth of everybody else. That Mikra has an entirely different perspective. He thinks this whole list is a list of who came to Yerushalayim in the very beginning of the return under Zerubbabel. He has an entirely different take, and I just get a headache every time I read it. So I don't know what to do with it, but I presented it because it makes it more complete. But fundamentally, what we're trying to say here is the leadership goes under Nehemiah to be in Yerushalayim. It seems that they volunteer to do so. And then from the nation, you're going to pull a certain percentage who are going to show up as well, although it could be that there were people from the nation as a whole who volunteered also. Was that clear? Is that clear? Okay, Gita.
Yeah, there's no percentage of the leaders. In other words, all the leaders have to go, or are they themselves volunteering?
So that's really hard to tell, because we don't know anything about leaders who are elsewhere. It doesn't say. So that's why I don't know whether all of leaders go or not. All the leaders who we enumerate here go. That I can tell you. Okay. So let's go through our list. We're not going to spend a lot of time on each name. We're going to spend almost no time on each name. But I want to show the hierarchy that we will see among the leaders who actually are dwelling there. So, Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Actually, 4 we read. Right, I referenced it already. It's Yehuda and Binyamin who are there, and we saw Ataya, Uziah, Zechariah, Mayashvati, Mahalalel, Peretz. And then in Hay, again, one family from Shelah, Maaseya, Baruch, Kolchozeh, Chazaya, Adaya, Yehoyariv, Zechariah, Shelah. And yes, as Alina noted, some of these names are names we're familiar with. Maaseya is familiar, we've seen a Baruch, we've seen Zechariah, Yehoyariv is a big name among the Kohanim. Kol b'nei Peretz hayoshvim b'Yerushalayim, all of the descendants of Peretz who dwell in Yerushalayim, arba me'os shishim u'shmona, 468, anshei chayil. What are anshei chayil?
Men.
So it isn't necessarily men of a particular age, it's usually assumed to be warriors. That's the standard rendition of anshei chayil, although you will recall that when Moshe chooses judges, one of the criteria that Yisro gives him for the judges is anshei chayil. And the word chayil does not have to mean war or chayal at all, like in eshes chayil. Eish chayil is an impossible phrase to translate. There is no good translation into English. The best translation is unfortunately not really understood in popular English anymore, or it would be perfect. It would be woman of substance. It would be the best translation. Because what chayil really means is a combination of wealth and social standing. Is wealth and social standing with a fair bit of also good character. So Rus is called Eishes chayil for what she does on behalf of Naomi. But there's no like English word that sort of captures the substance. I think is really the best you can really do. Valor certainly doesn't do it. I don't know where valor came from as a translation. I don't know what King James was thinking. But Anshei Chayil is of the same bent. These are people of substance. That's what we're trying to say here. I'm sorry? Yes, that's the problem with trying to use modern English for it. Correct. That's what people will think if you say substance. Okay. But these are the people from Yehuda, and then we get the people from Binyamin. Ve'ela b'nei Binyamin, and here is the Binyamin list. Once again, we're going to trace one family through multiple generations. Salum, Meshulam, Yoed, Pedaya, Kolaya, Maaseya. There's that name again, Maaseya. You can see why it's a popular name. Maaseya is actually a nice name. It means deed of God. Right? If you call your child act of God, it means you're saying it's a hurricane. No, but the insurance people won't cover it. That's your Maaseya name, ETL, which has made a comeback, I think, in Israel, the name ETL. Also a nice name. It means God is with me. It's a good name. Ben Yeshaya. Ve'acharav, and after him. After him means what? No, not a son. Sorry. Take a look at number 11 on your sheet. Va'acharav, Mitzvah David says, B'ma'ala v'chashivut. People of lesser standing. So this one had great standing, and then next to him, Gabai Salai. Chameos Esu Mushmono, all together 928. Gabai Salai is usually assumed by most to be actual names. It doesn't mean a group. It sounds like a name for a word for a group, but it means names. The best way we usually treat it. V'yoel ben Zichri Pakid Alehem, and here we get our first Pakid. We will meet three Pakidim. A Pakid is what? Sorry? An officer, someone in charge of something. Literally, a pikuda is an order. So you could say someone with a job to do. But this person is commissioned to be a leader. They translate it as officer?
Overseer.
Okay. They are not an overseer in the sense of like you're building pyramids and they're whipping you, but an overseer in the sense of a governor of sorts. He's in charge of these Yehuda Binyamin people. The Yehuda ben Hasinua al Ha'ir Mishneh, and the second in command, the Mishneh, was Yehuda ben Hasinua. Right, so with Snua, the truth of the matter is that I could make the argument that Snua with a sin is hatred, not with a Sama. But those letters switch back and forth regularly. I don't know the positive meaning of Snua. Remember that we saw a name of Sinav ben Binyamin, right, in the list of those who brought the wood korbanos for the Beis HaMikdash. So I don't know if it's somehow related to that. I don't know what the positive read of snuah could be, but there is one. We just have to be familiar enough with Semitic languages. For example, the one that I always thought was very funny was among the Nisim, the leaders of the tribe, there's someone named Achira. Achira, which sounds like something that you name your sibling, right? Sibling rivalry. Hey, my brother is, yeah, that's Achira over there. But it's not what it means. What does Achira actually mean? No. Ah and Re'ah, friend. Achira is a brother and a friend. It's a much nicer name. I still wouldn't use it. No.
It's like that Shua.
I don't understand. Re'im? Yeah, Achira. So I have to think there's something here with Snua that actually comes out with a positive meaning, but no, I probably wouldn't use it either. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Well, one silly thing is Na'i, which is a
swirl, right. I can't figure out what that is.
But all the other ones are Ben Men.
And that one is also. Snua has to be a male name.
Male?
Yeah.
So then Snua.
I'm saying, it doesn't mean hated, and it's not in the feminine. The question is, what is the word, and I don't know.
Yeah,
because
the
hay could be part of the name. Correct.
So this is etymology. We're trying to figure out by the roots what the word is.
Yeah. I think that the name catches people's eye and so they want to know, but I don't have a real answer for you. The Psukim Yud to Yudalid, 10 to 14, give us the Kohanim. We went through Yehuda Binyamin. Now we hit the Kohanim. So min haKohanim, from the Kohanim, Yedaya ben Yoyariv Yachin, and these are names of shifts that are found in the lists of the shifts of the Kohanim. Sariah is a big name because it was Ezra's father. So some suggest that's actually who we're referring to here. Sariah, who's the son of Chilkiah, son of Meshulam, son of Tzadok, son of Rayot, son of Achitub, Negid Beis HaElokim. Negid Beis HaElokim means the person who is in charge of the house of God. That's what Negid Beis HaElokim means. This is the person who is in charge of the Beis HaMikdash.
Is it
on the Kohen Gadol? No, it doesn't necessarily mean the Kohen Gadol, but more of an administrative role, correct. A Negid is a leader. The Limshoch in Hebrew, in the Chumash, like Mishchu Uchulachem, regarding the Karban Pesach, is translated as Negidu. It's to draw people along. Hence the title, go back to 10th century Spain, the leader of the Jewish community was Hanagid, right? Shmuel Hanagid. So that's the, you know, it's much more of an administrative position, I think, than a religious position. Va'achehem, and this, by the way, though, the idea that this as his father Saraya feeds into Dat Mikra's idea that this list is an old list from when they first came to settle. Va'achehem, and their brethren, Osei Hamalacha Labayis, who do the work for the house, which Rashi explains means the Avoda. They do the work in the Beis HaMikdash on a daily basis, bringing the Karbanot, bringing the offerings. Their brethren, who do the work, Shmona Meos Estrimu Shnayim, 822 of them. And Adaya, son of Yerocham, Plalya, Amtzi, Zechariah again, Hashchur, which is the name we've seen as well, Malkiah, Ve'echav, and his brethren, this fellow Adaya and his brethren, Rashim La'avos, heads of families, Masayim V'arbayim Ushnayim, 242. I'm not keeping track of the numbers. You don't need to either. There's no total coming at the end. V'ammash Sai, Ben Azarel, Ben Achzai, Ben Meshile Mot, Ben Imer, Va'achayim, and their brethren, Gibore Chayo, we are also people of substance, Mea Esrim Ushmona, 128, Ufakid Aleihem, here's your second Pakid, Yudim Binyamin had somebody in charge, so did the Kohenim, Zavdiel. Zavdiel is a nice one also, right? Zevet is a gift, right? Zevet Habat. So, Zvadani Elokimoti Zevet Tov. Zavdiel, a gift from God, Ben Hagidolim, son of the great ones. Now, that is clearly not a name. The Dat Mikra points out something very interesting. When you look in old Babylonian and Persian inscriptions, you find a similar term used for those who held royal power. So Ben Hagdolim would mean a descendant from those who had that kind of authority. He says it's parallel. If you translate those words into Hebrew, you would end up with Gedolim. So that's what he says Hagdolim means. So that's our second Pakid. And then we get the Levim. Umin Aleviim from Levi, Shemaya ben Chashuv ben Azrikam ben Chashavia ben Buni. Okay, we've seen Buni before. That name has come up. It's the one that kind of sticks in your head. V'shabsai v'yozavad al hamalacha hachitzona leveisa elokim me'rashay haleviim. The Shabtai and Yozavad are in charge of the malacha that is done externally for the house of God. From the heads of the Levium, what does that mean? What is the external work?
Groundskeepers.
So that's why Rashi takes it, is that it's essentially groundkeepers, upkeep of the building, bringing wood for the Mizbeach. I think I brought you. Did I bring you Rashi on this? No, I did not. But that's what he says. That's Rashi's take. Ibn Ezra says that it's work done outside. I'm sorry, I brought him to Stat David because he has the same idea, but he says it explicitly in number 12. Hayu memunim al hamalacha nasa chutz lamikdash. They were appointed upon the work done outside the temple. Vehilat sarech hamikdash, which is for the sake of the temple, could go in such as lavi etzim va'avanim letzarech bedek habayis uchadome, to bring wood, to bring stones for the sake of the upkeep of the building and the like. That's Rashi Mitzvah David. Ibn Ezra says it's work done outside the city on behalf of the Beis HaMikdash. Sometimes you need agents, right? They have to go elsewhere, so that's their job. They take care of things beyond. However, Dat Mikra does something fascinating. And here I think you hear a very interesting point. One of the things that you could totally miss if you just skip things like this, but we're not going to miss it. Take a look at Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Chronicles 1. I gave you the references there in number 13, so you can see it. Chronicles 1, chapter 26. You want page 1931. This is a division of the tribe of Levi, who did which jobs. going back into the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash, I believe. Yeah, it has to be. So, look at what it says in sentence 20. Sorry, sentence 20. Sentence 20. It says, V'halevi'im, the Levi'im were, Achiyah was in charge of Otzrot Beit HaElokim, the stores of the house of God. U'Otzrot HaKadoshim, the stores of that which had been dedicated. What's wrong? We're in chapter 26, sentence 20. And it's going to give us then a whole division of Levite families. And now jump to 29, which is the king. Here is what the family of Yitzhar had. La Yitzhari, for the family of Yitzhar, Kenanyahu Ubanav, La Malacha HaChitzona, for the external work, Al Yisrael, La Shotrim, Ula Shoftim. For the Shotrim and the Shoftim. Shotrim are what?
Please.
Officers, enforcement. And the Shoftim are the judges. So what does this tell me the Levium are responsible for?
The judicial
system. They are the judges. Law and order. But you're putting Levi in charge of adjudication. So what was interesting to me when I looked at this was, why didn't Rashi and Mitzudat Levi quote this? They know Divrei Hayamim very well. They have no problem knowing what's in Chronicles. That's not the issue. So why did they choose to describe what we said here, right, going back to our sentence, Malacha Chitzona Lebeit HaElokim, why didn't they give this explanation?
Was it Levi who was in charge?
Levi in both places.
No. I'm saying originally.
I mean, in the Torah, it's the Torah of Yisharefa, so you appoint them from, it seems like it's from your midst, rather than from externally.
In the past, were the Levium part of the judicial process?
Well, the Torah says that when you have a problem, you go to Kohanim v'Halevium v'Al HaShofet asher yevayim emahim. The Kohen, the Levi, the Shofet will be around in that time. So why didn't we give this as our explanation? Kohanim and Levium are involved in the judicial process. Why didn't you say that? I have two answers. One of which is textual, and the other one of which is philosophical. What's the textual one? Catch the difference between Nehemiah 11:16 and the verse here in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles. What's the difference? Nope, they're both malacha. Good. In the one in Nehemiah said malacha chitzona, the external work for the house of God. The one in Divrei Hayamim says the external work for Israel, the Yisrael. So that's the textual difference. However, I wanted to go a little further with this. There is a classic debate about whether judging and teaching was originally exclusively the province of the Kohanim. Was this a system, this goes back to our conversation from before, in which there's a Kohen-led society, and then post-temple it becomes rabbinically-led society, which doesn't fit certain elements, is what we were talking about before. It doesn't fit certain elements, meaning you have here in the beginning of the Second Temple rabbinic legislation led by Nehemiah, who is not a Kohen, right, in this whole pact that we read about before. And you find rabbinic leadership going back into the Chumash. It's not like, you know, it's not like you can really draw a line like that.
Well, Moshe had this opinion. There was not...
Correct.
And the idea, Yitro's suggestion, etc. This was not what the... Was it the Kohanim were maybe in ritual, or judges in ritual areas?
Maybe, but it doesn't sound like it in the Chumash. It says when you have an issue with somebody else, go to the Kohen, the Levi, and the judge will be there in those days. It doesn't sound like it. But I think that what you could be seeing here is a resistance by Rashi, Mitzvah David, Ibn Ezra, to saying that the Kohanim and Levium are the Shoftim, the Shotrim. They don't envision it working that way. Helped by the fact that the text here says Beit Elokim versus Yisrael. However, there's a medrash that says that, in fact, that's exactly what it is. Shoftim v'shotrim. Take a look on your sheet, number 14. Completely separate area of Jewish law. This is from Mechilta. The Mechilta is halachic medrash on the book of Shmot. as opposed to story medrash, shmod rabba, if you will. This is halachic medrash, and they're dealing with the question of whether a beit din, a rabbinical court, is allowed to function on Shabbos. And they say no. And they say, how do you know you're not allowed to function on Shabbos? Minayin ledinin ulatanot uliir urin ulchol maaseh beit din. How do you know that judgments, claims, appeals, acts of the court are all shnikruim melacha? Irur in modern Hebrew is an appeal. Whether irur they meant that or challenges to the validity of a document, you can discuss. It doesn't matter for our purposes. But the point for our purposes, it says, how do you know these are all called melacha, meaning for Shabbos purposes? Talmud Lomar, because the text says what we saw here in Divrei Yom Aleph, right? The melacha there of the shotrim and the shoftim. It brings you this verse over there to tell you that it is melacha. So the truth is, no, I take that back. That doesn't prove anything. It's dealing with the sentence over there. It's not dealing with our sentence. All right, scratch that. I had a nice idea there. No, that's not it. Oh well. Win some, you lose some. But what you do see, I think, is a statement that this can't be that. What the Levim are working on can't be can't be mishpat. That's not their formal capacity. Okay. Back in the Pesukim, I thought I had something else there, but if I come back to it and find it, then I'll email it to everybody. Blue Nether. Take a look at Pasuk Yud Zayin, sentence 17.
In
Nehemiah again. Right. 1863. Or something like that. Sorry? 1865 now. Good. Progress. Matanya, son of Micha, son of Zamdi, son of Asaf, Rosh Hatchila Yehodeh Latifila. That is a fancy title. And he has a second in command whose name is Bakbukia. Okay, Mishneh Me'achav, second in command from his brothers, as well as Avda, son of Shemua, son of Galal, son of Yedutun. So Rosh Hatchila Yehodeh Latfila. They translate that very nice rhyming title here as the leader of beginning the thanksgiving at prayer. Right, Rosh, the head, Hatchila for the beginning, Yehodeh Hoda'ah, thanks, Latfila for prayer. So in other words, this is the Levi who leads the singing in the Beis HaMikdash. That's the classic take. Malbim has a different view, but pretty much everybody else assumes, and that's what they translated here, that he's the lead singer in the Beis HaMikdash. Kol ha-Leviim bi'ir ha-Kodesh masayim shmonim ve'arba'a. All of the Leviim in the Holy City, 284. Did you notice what happened in this sentence? It was something that actually happened once earlier in this chapter, but here it stands out. Uh-oh. What did we call Yerushalayim here? Here HaKodesh. When did that happen? That's a new name. Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh. Today, we're so used to it. Right? But where does that name come from? It actually was used in the beginning of the chapter. No one pointed it out, including me. But I noticed it when I was preparing this. It was in the opening sentence, right? It said, "Usharam, etc. L'shemes Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh." There are only, courtesy of Bar Ilan University CD-ROM, there are only two other places in Tanakh where Yerushalayim is called Yir HaKodesh, and they're both in Yeshaya. I gave you the references in number 15. Yeshaya Perak Memchet Pasuk Bet 48:2, and then Perak Nun Bet Pasuk Aleph 52:1. What is the significance of the name Yeshaya? Of the name Yeshaya, the name Yir HaKodesh.
Well, in your citation, you capitalize Holy City.
Yes.
In my translation, that's not capitalized.
Well,
it's just a descriptor.
Okay, but it becomes such a name for Yerushalayim.
But other things are capitalized here.
Uvnei Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, right? I mean, it's Yerushalayim's second name, like Rabbeinu is Moshe's second name, you know? So where does this... Yeah, what is the significance of this phrase and why are we using it here? So if you take a fast look at Yeshaya, at the way that it's used there, we may gain some insight. Chapter 48, sentence 2, it's page 1039. Page 1039, it's chapter 48, sentence 2.
Okay.
Yeshaya says, I'm just going to read it out quickly. Hear this, O house of Jacob, who are called by the name of Israel, and who emerge from the fount of Judah, who swear by the name of Hashem and make mention of the God of Israel, but not in truth and not in righteousness. Rather, because they are called after the holy city and they rely on the God of Israel. This is a message of rebuke. Right? Yeshaya is rebuking the people. And he says, you call the name of God, swear in the name of God, not in truth, not in righteousness, just because you're named after the holy city. By the way, in capitals here in the translation.
Here is in capitals.
There also.
But here it is.
Fascinating.
Could have been in the...
But that's one use. And then jump to 52:1. It's on page 1045. Okay. We will now have seen all four uses in Tanakh of Yirat Kodesh. Uri, Uri. Awaken, awaken. Right? Don your strength, O Zion. Don your garments of splendor, O Jerusalem. Ir HaKodesh, the holy city. Here it's not capitalized.
No, it's not.
But why? For uncircumcised and defiled people will no longer enter you. No longer will you be contaminated. In other words, the idea of Ir HaKodesh... Ir HaKodesh has special standing. Ir HaKodesh means something. It distinguishes it from impurity. It distinguishes it from impropriety. Take a look on your sheet at source number 16. This is Radak in Yeshaya, in Isaiah. He says, this is, I'm going to do with the English in the interest of time, this is Jerusalem, which is the holy city. For God chose it as the residence of His Shechina, which is the sanctity of Israel. You, the people, should have been holy. You should not have contaminated the city on whose name you are called. In other words, it's a message of rebuke. This city is Kodesh, why weren't you Kodesh? This city is holy, you, its residents, should have been holy. That's the way Yeshaya is using it, the way Isaiah uses it. And I think we could expand from that and say the same thing is true here. Because we use it, yeah?
It's more of a forewarning, like, don't do.
In a sense, yeah.
Right.
It's a statement of a standard.
Referencing back to, like you're saying, the people would know that sound, that it was only used in review.
I'm not sure I would go that way.
Maybe.
But even without assuming familiarity with Yeshaya, I would have just said that it's bracketing the residents of Yerushalayim. Meaning we use it in the opening sentence. Right? We're talking about the elite who choose to live there. We introduce the list in sentence 1 with them, and we conclude the list here in sentence 18. We're almost done with the list. Now we're going to go by jobs and the shorim, the gatekeepers. Sorry? No, my message is not that it's a rebuke. What I'm trying to say is, in Yeshaya, it is used in chapter 48 as rebuke because they didn't live up to that standard. And here it's being used to set the standard that you will have to live up to. It's trying to say, this is a holy city. You can't just live here. You have to live here as one lives in a holy city.
So it's turning the city into a temple.
Yes. This city is a sanctuary of sorts. That is exactly what I see here. Ir HaKodesh is an important declaration.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes. They always has been an aspiration. Finally, see, I really would have liked it if it had been in sentence 19. Because 19 is the last sentence that actually lists people who live there. But I'm going to go with it anyway. Because 19 sort of blends in with the gatekeepers and the jobs of the Levium that go forward. V'hashoarim, the gatekeepers. Akub, Tamon, their brethren who guard the gates. Hashomim, Basharim, 172. And then it says, Ushar Yisrael and the rest of the Jews. Kohanim, Levium, are b'chol arei Yehuda, are in all the other cities, not in the Ir HaKodesh. Ish b'nachal aso, they scattered to their portions, and the Netinim, we saw this in chapter 3, Yoshvim ba'Ofel, they live in the place called Ofel. The Netinim are separate from everybody else. Those were the ones who worked for the Beis HaMikdash, and we talked about their issue of whether they could marry in. I brought you the Yerushalmi in number 17, which we saw when we came across this earlier in the book, that the Netinim are segregated from everybody else, and we're not going to reopen that whole discussion right now, but Sicha and Gishpa are in charge of the Netinim. Finally, Pasuk Chav Beis, sentence 22. The officer, the Pakid, the third officer we have over the Levium in Yerushalayim is Uzi, son of Bani Hashavi, Matanya, Micha, from the descendants of Asaph, one of the singers, is more like Asaph. Leneged Meleches Beis Elokim. So their responsibility is opposite the work of the house of God, which Rashi says means they have to spend the money of the temple for upkeep of the building and for its work. That's the way Rashi understands this. Ki mitzvahs hamelech aleihem, in accordance with the instructions of the king. Ki mitzvah, like ki mitzvah. In accordance with the instructions of the king, that they should take care of this. Va'amana, ala mesharim dvar yom biyamo. And they had a responsibility to take care of those who sang in the temple each day to provide for them. Uvsachya ben b'shei zav'el mibnei zerach ben Yehuda liyad ha-melech l'chol davar la'am. And Psachya, son of b'shei zav'el, the sons of Zerach of Yehuda, liyad ha-melech. So liyad ha-melech means he's an agent of the Persian king. L'chol davar la'am, for all of the matters of the nation. Sorry? Yes. Psachya ben b'shei zav'el is from Yehuda. He's from Judea. From Judah.
So the Persian king used him,
So it appears. It is funny, the Dat Mikra thinks that the earlier Melech, when it said, Ki mitzvat ha-melech aleihem, in accordance with the command of the king, thought that that was actually King David, David ha-melech. But here he thinks that this is the Persian king. I would have assumed both were the Persian king. Okay. So that's who lives in Yerushalayim. That's the job, the set of jobs that are carried out by them. The rest of this chapter is just a list of who lives, which families live in other cities. It starts with Hebron. Kiryat Arba uses the historic name of Kiryat Arba for Hebron as the most important city in the mountains of Judea. And then it lists the other cities from the south, which were settled here, cities of Yehuda, of Judea. So that's the basic Perek Yudal, chapter 11. What I want to do next time is Perek Yud Bet and start on Yud Gimel, and then the week after that, finish Yud Gimel. And then I'll probably record a review shiur, or if enough people are around, we'll give one. But I expect to be done on the 26th. So, thank you very much.
So I, because